Good afternoon from USC's Annenberg Media Center, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For Thursday, April 5th, 2018, I'm Kaylee Wells. But first, a news update with Sebastian Vega.
An earthquake rattled parts of Southern California around noon today. The U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS, recorded the quake at a 5.3 magnitude. It originated near the Channel Islands south of Santa Barbara. The earthquake was too far from the coast and too small to trigger any tsunami concerns. There have not been any reports of any damage or injury. During the quake, the USGS tested an early warning system with some mobile phone users. One Los Angeles user credited the app with giving her more than 30 seconds of warning time to take action and find cover. Today's incident was the largest recorded earthquake near the Channel Islands since 2013. Suspects connected to recent thefts of USC's students' cell phones remain at large. The criminal activity that took place just off campus is making students question their safety and whether the yellow-jacketed safety ambassadors stationed in neighborhoods around campus are even enough to stop a crime. DPS Assistant Chief David Carlisle says they aren't supposed to intervene.
Security ambassadors' duty is to observe and report. In other words, if they saw the robberies in progress, it is not their job to confront the thieves. It's their job to contact DPS.
USC's Department of Public Safety says no suspects have been found yet, but they're hopeful that with the detailed photos of the robbers' vehicles, an arrest will come soon. LA is working to bring science and technology to its young students. Trevor Sohaki has the report.
LA Mayor Eric Garcetti and celebrity scientist Bill Nye made appearances at City Hall today for the beginning of the third annual City of STEM, LA's largest celebration of science, technology, engineering, and math. The goal of the month-long festivities is to foster interest in STEM fields amongst young people in the region. Nye believes LA can be a world leader through education.
Los Angeles can be a model for the world. It's a world city. We can ensure that our home here remains a world leader by providing science, engineering, and math curricula to students of all ages.
Throughout April, City of STEM partners will present science-themed events and activities around Southern California. Garcetti looks forward to inspiring the youth here in LA.
I don't want to just count on amazing talent coming here from other places. I want to make sure it grows up here too, that our young people see that they can reach for the stars no matter what their zip code is right here in LA.
The festival also aims to grow appreciation for SoCal's legacy in STEM. For Annenberg Media, I'm Trevor Sahaki.
Students of Howard University are protesting for change following reports of a financial aid scandal earlier last week. Alexandria Mason reports.
Students at Howard University are taking a stand by sitting in. For 8 days, students have occupied a campus administration building with a list of demands. Protests kicked off last week when an anonymous whistleblower took to Medium to expose ongoing financial abuses in the financial aid office, alleging that employees stole up to $1 million in aid. The university president, Wayne Frederick, wrote in a statement that 6 employees were fired late last year for the misappropriation of funds at the historically black college. Since news broke, students have made it clear that this issue will not be brushed under the table.
We have 9 demands that all center around giving students more power at school so that they can feel like higher stakeholders in this university.
That's Maya McCollum. She's in her first year at Howard and is a part of the leading student group that's been protesting for change in the sit-ins. She says the scandal was particularly frustrating because financial aid for students continues to be a huge campus issue.
When it comes to actually getting things processed, to getting things signed, financial aid here takes a very long time. And that's why a lot of these demands were formed, because a lot of students had already accepted that these systematic issues that Howard has would just stay this way.
Over the past 8 days, sit-in participants have fostered their own community, and organizers have even made headway on 7 of their 9 demands, including an end to unsubstantiated tuition hikes and adequate housing for all students under 21. However, one of the biggest demands, the resignation of the president, has yet to be met. For Annenberg Media, I'm Alexandria Mason.
Tonight, we'll see some cloudy skies with lows dipping into the low 70s. Tomorrow, the highs are going to get up to the upper 60s and low 70s. The clouds stick around through the weekend with a 50% chance of rain on Saturday, and then sunny skies and low 70s to finish out the weekend. Right now, it's 62 degrees outside the Media Center at USC. Mayor Eric Garcetti announced yesterday that LA ranks number one in the country for installed solar panels. That's according to a report by the Environment California Research and Policy Center. Today, we have Annenberg Media's Drew Jones in the studio to tell us a little bit about how USC measures up to the rest of the city. How's it going, Drew?
Good. Thanks so much for having me, Sebastian.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. So tell us a little bit about how, you know, USC measures up to, you know, other colleges in Los Angeles with their solar panel and solar energy.
So compared to UCLA and LMU, USC is kind of behind a little bit. LMU actually has 81,000 feet of solar panels on their campus, and USC only has a small area of solar panels that power a student-ran garden.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so why is it that USC is maybe lagging behind some of these other top universities like UCLA?
So I actually spoke with a former USC sustainability manager last semester, and she says that solar panels are, of course, an interest for the university, but they want to make sure it makes financial sense. So if they purchase solar panels and the buildings aren't efficient, they're not going to get incentives or rebates or anything like that.
Yeah. And so if we're not investing into solar panels and solar energy, what are we investing into?
They actually just started a tailgate waste diversion program that's been powered through the last couple of years. And they're doing other things with waste management on campus, switching waste management companies and doing more recycling and sorting. And now there's no plastic straws in the cafeterias as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Drew.
No problem.
Drivers across the country are feeling more pain at the pump. Reporter Camila Rios says relief might be far off.
The average price of a gallon of regular gas in L.A. County rose 0.2 cents today to $3.58, its highest since August of 2015. This peak increase is part of a steady incline of L.A. County's gasoline prices, with average prices going up 30 out of the last 31 days. I spoke to South L.A. resident Yolanda James about the ways in which the hikes in gas prices affect her.
Driving me crazy. I can't even buy me no food half of the time, and it only affects us poor people, this ones that's really trying to go around, get jobs, and make ends meet. It's either your gas tank or your food, and then sometimes it's your rent too, because I know a lot of my friends sleeping in their cars.
Let's put things into perspective. The average price of gasoline is 1.5 cents more than a week ago, 15.5 cents more than a month ago, and 55.5 cents more than a year ago. Skyrocketing gas prices are not unique to Los Angeles County. Orange County's gas prices are the highest they've been since 2015, and San Diego County is experiencing the same trend. With summer just around the corner, there isn't much hope prices will go down anytime soon. For Annenberg Media, I'm Camila Rios.
It is 8 minutes after the hour. I'm Sebastian Vega.
Thanks so much, Sebastian. Coming up on From Where We Are, we hear about the everyday life of a woman known as the Goddess of Los Angeles. You may have seen clothing lines with t-shirts pinned to them on campus this week. They're in recognition of Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Here's Sam Dodge.
It's called the Clothesline Project, an art installation that details the stories of sexual assault survivors on colorful t-shirts. They lie in Alumni Park in front of Doheny Library. It's put on by the Student Assembly for Gender Empowerment, also known as SAGE. Tessa Moore is a member of SAGE.
I think it's really powerful to hear from survivors themselves. A lot of times there's so much stigma around this issue that survivors don't come out and tell their story. And so this offers a way for them to tell their story while still maintaining their anonymity and still being safe from their assailants. And for that, it's really powerful.
SAGE will host various workshops, panels, and other activities throughout April to honor survivors and bring awareness to campus. For Annenberg Media, I'm Sam Dodge.
Nearly 20 years ago, a college student named Matthew Shepard was brutally beaten, tied to a fence, and left to die in Laramie, Wyoming. Many believe that Shepard, who was gay, was the victim of a hate crime. The killing continues to resonate with composer Craig Hella Johnson. He wrote his first concert-length piece of music in response to the murder. It's called Considering Matthew Shepard. Johnson will perform the music with the USC Thornton Chamber Singers this Sunday at Bovard Auditorium. Liz Warner spoke with him about it.
I'm Liz Warner, and I'm here with Craig Hella Jansen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
What was the moment that you decided that this was something that needed to be written about?
Well, there were probably two moments that formed my moment, and one was actually in 1998. I was the artistic director of a men's vocal ensemble called Chanticleer, based in San Francisco. And one of the singers, I came to rehearsal in this October day in October 1998, and a singer whose name was Matt Alber, came to me in tears before the rehearsal began, and I asked him what was wrong, and he said his name was Matt. And he just sobbed, and he had just learned about Matthew Shepard at that time. And I remember then after that rehearsal, learning more and hearing more, and as the whole world did. And it really pierced me deeply. And at that time, that was probably the moment of my response, like, I have to express something here. But it just went in really, really deep. Fast forward many years later, I had gone through years feeling kind of haunted by this notion that I wanted to still respond, and very frustrated with myself that I hadn't, in a way, because it felt so important, but it felt kind of too deep almost. And then come around 2012, I finally said, you know, this feels really important that I, just personally for me, it's important that I respond. And, you know, I thought, do I want to write a passion? I conduct the Bach passions a lot, and so know those works well, and that was in my repertoire, of course. And then I thought, or I just write a song, or just what is it? And so that's 2012 is when I said, I'm going to do this. I scheduled a date for a workshop performance, whatever it would become, and put that stake in the ground. And that was in May of 2014 that we did a workshop. And then in 2016, I had completed the complete work that we have today. And we did the premiere then in February of 2016.
Do you feel that with the approach that you've taken, it has opened up the idea to more people than just that classical community?
Yeah, it's been incredible. I mean, it's been tremendously joyful. You know, all my classical colleagues really understand what it is to live inside an oratorio. You know, we know what that is. Or, you know, these large forms that we grew up knowing well, even in this iPod shuffle, you know, influenced generation with short 3-minute attention spans. You know, I think their classical folks still love the large forms. And so there's that. And then there are people who have entry points. You know, there was a man just a few months ago who heard this country song called The Fence Before. And I mean, he was sort of not participating in the concert experience until that moment. And he said, wow, you really got me with that one. And I was with you the rest of the way. And I love to hear that kind of thing.
That's it's a great testament to the accessibility of it, which is important, I think, in this case, because it's such a huge issue. It's not just a person's life, and it is a person's life, but it's bigger than a person's life.
Right. Yes. And you know, it is, I did take a sort of a simple approach in the sense of wanting to be direct, because I wanted to be very careful not to create sort of fancy artifice around this kind of most essential theme and topic. And you know, the idea of facing difficult things, I'll just go right to the core of it to say facing death, whether literal death or the death in every day. You know, those are things we all do everything possible often to avoid, you know, for much of our lives. And so that was enough. I mean, that's sort of dense enough to ask an audience to take that journey. And so I wanted the musical means to be sure that it was clear, speaking, and direct, and that it needed to be, you know, obviously very authentic, coming from me, kind of this inquiry into exploration to allow people to actually be invited to that place that I wanted to say, let's meet at that fence, let's meet at that difficult place and ask this question together, because this world seems to be spinning out of control right now. And I crave and yearn for a way back home to myself, to this life, what it means to live authentically with each other. And so that's a heart yearning for me.
Thank you, Craig Hella Jansen, and we look forward to the performances.
Thank you so much.
With the Augusta Masters Tournament beginning today and Tiger Woods teeing off, golf is back in sports headlines. Mara Pometti speaks to one local golfer who discovered a passion in facing the mental challenge of the game.
Play up!
My first name's Ivan, last name is Acevedo, and I'm self-employed. I work in finance, and I play a lot of golf. I started playing golf maybe when I was about 20 years old, and just played just for fun and with friends, and ever since then, you know, just playing more and more, I guess, as I get older. It's outside, it makes you think, it makes you, you know, struggle and learn how to just recover from making mistakes. I really like the sport in that it applies in a lot of ways to real life.
Good. Get up, keep going. Nice shot.
I love how difficult the sport is.
Oh.
They make it look really easy on TV, but the problem is that it's actually a really tough game.
Oh. In the hole!
Too much.
Just spending a day out having fun like this and not making it serious, not getting mad, that's important.
Oh, that's good, Jerry.
Oh, Jerry.
Oh, that's good ball.
But it's fun. That's all it is.
Oh.
Before we go.
Are you gonna go in for a drink?
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
We'll get one.
Thank you. There. For sure.
Right? So sure. And we're outside, it's a beautiful day, right? So
you're close to everything. You're close to being outside, the fresh air, the mountains. You're one with nature. That's what I love about golf too.
That sound portrait was produced by Mara Pometti. People come to California to build new lives, to leave their past behind, to make something of themselves, and hopefully make money while they're at it. That's the California dream. And the not-so-family-friendly story of one woman who tries to find wholeness through some unconventional means. And if you have young ears in the car, be warned this story might not be appropriate for them. Bradley Bermont has the story.
My name is Grace Marie, and I'm the goddess of Los Angeles.
But before she was a goddess, Grace was a preschool teacher. And while it wasn't about the money...
Let's keep it very real. I had a mountain of medical bills. You know, the school district was great, but they didn't make me rich.
She wanted to stay in California, but it's an expensive place to live. And she wanted to stay because her family was here, her support system was here, and obviously the weather was perfect. So... she became...
Where did my fist go?
A dominatrix.
Where did it go, Sleeve Anthony?
Now, I couldn't actually record one of her sessions with any clients for obvious reasons, but instead pulled some sounds from social media. Let's just say a little goes a long way. Like this one, where a man is effectively trapped in a latex bag with a hole for his head, and he's forced to walk on his elbows and knees. Grace and her friends have turned him into their dog.
And you can wag your tail if you wag your feet. Oh, my beloved and sacred goddess, my mind is so confused.
I'm standing in her 10th floor apartment in the middle of Park La Brea, and this is a text one of her slaves sent her.
More each day, I long for a gag in my mouth, cuffs on my limbs, my goddess. It's a perfect love in a way.
Because it never has to encounter reality.
Exactly.
When Grace first started, she was in the midst of a 4-year on-again, off-again relationship with a kinky video artist who liked to lick boots. And that led Grace to an unfamiliar corner of a very familiar website.
There were people on Craigslist offering like 250 quote-unquote roses for foot worship.
Craigslist recently deleted the personal section where Grace used to find work, but at the time it still existed, and there was a guy who lived nearby.
I drove to his house in my little Prius and my little mom-mobile, and then I got out and clip-clopped inside with my heels and shoved my foot down his throat.
What were the emotions going through your head?
Excitement. The first time you get like $300 for an hour's worth of work, it's kind of like a rush. And suddenly you're like, oh my God, finally they're paying me what I'm worth. I'm obviously a goddess, you know, clearly. Like, this is it. Like, I've arrived.
Grace left the school district when her son, James, was 12. But he didn't find out that she was a dominatrix until 2 years later.
And he found one of my floggers.
A flogger is a type of really short whip, but instead of one tail, it is a bunch of them.
And he asked me why I had it. And I said the same thing I said to him when he asked me if Santa Claus was real when he was 4, which I said, do you want a story or do you want the truth?
And the truth was, he says he wasn't actually bothered when he found out. It helps that he had a great relationship with his mom.
Hell yeah. She's one of the best moms I know.
That's James. He just graduated high school, and he's studying to be a massage therapist.
I called her at 2 a.m. once because I needed to talk. She's always provided.
James is 19 now, but when he was calling his mom at 2 in the morning, well, he was much younger, and he was calling Grace because she wasn't living with them anymore. She moved out when he was 14, and she doesn't even like to say that she was a single mom because she left James with someone he considered to be his other mother.
I am Pat. I am Grace Marie's mother.
And Pat, she did not react well to Grace's career change.
I felt sad, and I felt embarrassed, and I felt shame.
Pat told Grace that if she was going to pursue this career, she wouldn't be doing it under the same roof as James.
My gut reaction was, this could hurt. She could get hurt.
But Grace didn't get hurt. On the contrary, she was doing the hurting in a very intimate way, she would like to add. She likes to be the unattainable woman.
You can never marry her. She's never going to be your girlfriend. She's never going to be in a traditional relationship with you at all.
We spent a lot of time together, and I asked her many times about what would drive her to do this. And she had a lot of different answers depending on the day. Until one day, I asked her what her childhood was like.
It was difficult. I don't know how to talk about that, actually. Actually, I really don't like to think about it because, like, I don't think it defines me now, you know?
Grace's mom was often working. Grace spent a lot of time with babysitters, and two of those babysitters molested her. One when she was only 6.
Like, it's weird to remember it because it's a memory now, so I don't know how it made me feel then, but I think the mind of it was the real, like, crux of it. And then that sort of shaped my worldview on, like, what love is.
Some people spend their lives trying to escape their past. Others use their past to change themselves. It's a quest for catharsis.
That mind imprint was left on me. So where does that live? It can live in the BDSM world if it's done well.
And using your past to become a new person? Well, isn't that the California dream?
Absolutely. Like, when a patron shows up on the first of the month with a stack of cash to show me that they want me to be safe with a roof over my head and with food in my fridge, that helps restore faith in human beings.
For the California Report, I'm Bradley Bermont.
Half months ago, we brought you the curious case of my stolen backpack. The case sounded all but closed, but this week, my laptop is back. And my colleague Alexandria Mason and I found out this is part of something so much bigger than a petty theft.
It was late November when one of our own, Kaylee Wells, told the story of when someone shattered the window of her car and took everything inside. She gave LAPD a play-by-play on her own investigation. Her tracking device placed her backpack in Santa Monica, her license was up in Bakersfield, and the credit card was added to an Amazon account that looked to be tied to someone in the Bay Area. Bel Air PD said that was enough information to pursue a potential suspect, and it sounded like the case was growing colder by the day. And then this week, Kaylee got the call from Fremont Police, and, well, I'll let her tell you the rest.
They said the Apple ID was tied to my name. I sent them my original police report, and once they verify it, my computer is coming home. They said I'll get it in the mail by next week. But here's the crazy part. It turns out my computer is one of about 3,000 stolen laptops, tablets, and phones that were on their way to Vietnam. It seemed like a typical Venice Beach car break-in, but I was just a small part of an international crime scheme. It started with a lot of car break-ins in the Bay Area, and then the investigation led detectives to a San Jose storage facility where more than 900 of the electronics were found. Two of the suspects were found when they tried to bring 18 pieces of luggage through customs to Vietnam. It turns out another 300 electronics were in those bags. All told, we're looking at about $2 million worth of stuff. The police said they think street-level criminals were doing the break-ins and then selling those to the people shipping them overseas. I called the Fremont police this morning and spoke with Lieutenant Michael Tegner from the Investigations Unit, who broke down the case a little bit more.
There was two layers to that. It was the people that were actually stealing the laptops from people's cars and were selling it to one person that we identified. There may have been more, but this is the one guy we identified. And then he was selling it to another person. And then that secondary fence was then shipping it to Vietnam.
That's how laptops and phones from Los Angeles and Las Vegas made their way up to San Jose. So they arrested 8 suspects, but the person who shattered my car window is probably not one of them. The police announced their findings in late January, but it's taken a while to find the owners of each of the pieces. That's why they didn't get to the box with my computer until this month. For weeks, I tried piecing together my own clues with tracker apps and credit card charges, but it was finals week, and I had a lot of work to make up in not a lot of time.
A lot of Kaylee's crisis has already come to an end. She got a new computer for Christmas, she turned in all her lost assignments, she moved on. But it has to be a good feeling knowing her clues were headed somewhere, even if LAPD brushed them off.
Thanks to associate producer Alexandria Mason for helping me tell the saga of my stolen backpack. Today on Street Smarts, we hear from Chandra Ingram about the teenagers who used to wander Hollywood Boulevard. Down on the
boulevard, they take it hard. Hollywood Boulevard is known by many for its glamour and fame. Tourists often confuse it for Beverly Hills or Sunset Boulevard, where the stars live. But in the 80s, Jackson Browne knew Hollywood Boulevard as the street for runaway kids. Long before this, in 1911, the city of Los Angeles adopted the town of Hollywood. Back then, the boulevard was a humble dirt road named Prospect Avenue, and Hollywood was a quaint town of churchgoers. Originally only 20 feet wide, the city renovated the road to 100 feet, with a new electrical railway running down the middle. By 1980, when Jackson Browne wrote a song Boulevard, the street had changed dramatically. Down at the Golden Cup, they set the young. During this time, there were an estimated 1,000 to 5,000 runaways in Hollywood. Young people would hang out at the intersection of Hollywood and Vine Street. Kids were fleeing sexual and physical abuse in their homes. So pimps and pedophiles took advantage of these vulnerable youth living around Hollywood Boulevard. With nowhere to go, many teenagers turned to prostitution and violence. In an interview, Browne said his song was about this period of time on the boulevard. Today, Hollywood Boulevard represents LA's film heritage. Tourists travel from all over the world to see the stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame and to visit the famous Chinese Theater and Wax Museum. For Annenberg Media, I'm Chandra Ingram.
LAX is now at the cutting edge of airport restroom technology. The LA International Airport installed new smart restrooms in one terminal on Wednesday. Called tush lights, the new toilet stalls feature lights that turn red or green to indicate whether or not a stall is occupied. They also feature touch pads to notify custodial staff of any messes to clean. LAX is expected to introduce tush lights to all terminals in the future. That's it from where we are today. Today's show is produced by me and our associate producer, Alexandria Mason. We had help today from Sam Scalbania. Chris Perfett is our board operator. The theme music was composed by Derek Renfro. Subscribe to From Where We Are on iTunes and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Ann Arbor Media. I am Kaylee Wells.